All right, good morning, everybody. It is Tuesday morning, May 4th, 9 a.m. And wow, we're getting down to the wire here. So looking at the calendar, we have four class meetings left. We have this week and next week, and then we go into finals week, I believe. Just gonna check my calendar really quick. I am not a super calendar person. I am more or less my entire life been calendar challenged. So yeah, that's true. So we've got four more class meetings and then we go into finals week. And just in thinking about what I want to get done and where I want to go and lecture, end of the semester sneaks up quick. It both sneaks up quick and it also feels a little bit strange because I feel like we started the semester a little bit late. And so we're ending a little bit late to where we normally end. It usually feels like we're wrapping up at this time and getting pretty close to finals week anyway. And it seems like it's pushed out just a little bit to me, but that's just time-wise. Otherwise in the class, it does. It feels like it goes pretty darn quickly. So realistically, I'm not going to have you guys write another lab report. There's no way that I'm going to tax you guys with that, with your other classes coming up and finals week and that sneaking up on you. So I'm not going to do that to you guys. I would still like to try to get those videos up and have you guys watch them, but I'm not going to have you write another lab report. The lecture class, we are in the middle of the conjugated systems and looking at Diels-Alder reactions. And we're just starting Diels-Alder reactions. And I think what I'm gonna do is in the interest of getting through some of the carbonyl chemistry, I'm gonna scale back some of the Diels-Alder stuff and not do it to the same level that we would normally do. This is interesting for me that I have always had a sense that my chemistry class is at a different level than most other university chemistry classes. And I've seen some of the materials from other classes. I've had students who have brought in exams from other classes, from other locations like UCSC and things. And, but I've never actually reviewed other people's curriculums besides maybe Zaruba. And Zaruba and I have coordinated so much that Zaruba has modeled his system after mine. And my daughter is in organic chemistry right now. She's in the second quarter of organic chemistry at Washington University and Western Washington University. And I've been helping her a lot through those two quarters. And the difference between what she's doing and what we're doing is like night and day. The way that they go over materials and they just sort of like skim over everything and never actually learn the mechanisms to the degree that we do. Or just for an instance, in the NMR and mass spec chapter, they didn't even learn how to do fragmentations. So mass spec, they didn't learn how to take and do a fragmentation to be able to figure out what the fragmentation patterns are. They talked about the molecular ion and the two isotope effects, bromide and chloride, and then that's it. And nothing else from mass spec. And so rule of 13, no. How to get the molecular formula? No, not part of their skill sets. They just move on. NMR, they didn't learn how to do spin-spin coupling and figuring out different types of coupling patterns or how to draw coupling patterns. And they just move on from the NMR. And so everything is just very surface. And that allows them to move a lot faster and they see a lot more. But what do they get out of it? I don't know that they get a whole lot out of it. Compared to what we do. And so we don't move as fast and we don't go through as much. But the material that you know solidly, and the skill sets that are solid. Keegan, as far as adjusting our exams, do you have a date? No, I don't have a date. What I would say is take a look at the quiz. If you want to adjust your exam, maybe just shoot me an email and let me know that you're going to make some changes so that if I'm grading things, then I leave yours out for a little bit until I get an email back that you've adjusted things. I don't anticipate that anybody is really going to want to adjust much of anything after looking at the quizzes. The quizzes were really pretty darn solid. And it's the NMR quiz that I was maybe a little bit more concerned about, not the mass spec quiz. The mass spec quiz was an easier type of quiz. So I really don't think you're going to want to adjust or do much of anything, but I'm just leaving that option there, that if you take a look at it, I know that people get nervous when they don't see things and then they're moving forward and doing the exam. And so, yeah, I don't think I said that on the recording yet. So I'm getting the quizzes back now. I know that the due date for the exam was last night. Anybody who wants to adjust their exam is certainly welcome to go back and adjust their exam after taking a look at the quizzes if they feel like the quizzes introduce new information or new ideas that would have helped them in that exam. I just don't think that's going to be the case. I think that you guys are going to see that on the quizzes that you guys did very well as a group, and that that your knowledge was pretty solid going into it. So I'm not overly concerned, but I'll let you guys make that decision for yourselves when you look at the quizzes and get them back. Okay, then you can take a look at your exams and see, and communicate to me if you want to switch something up, and I'm certainly open to doing that. So that leaves me questioning what we want to do this morning. I don't feel like I want to go into Diels Alder just yet, because that's what we're doing in lecture, and we haven't hit it enough. I've just told you sort of what the reaction looks like, not actually how the reaction works. And I was going to go through that with everybody in lecture, and it seems the more appropriate place. Practice problems wise, I'm looking back to see if there's anything with the conjugate additions that we could do that I could give you practice problem wise. Let me see what I've got. I may have a problem or two that we can work on.
Are we still going to do the scale reaction stuff, like mini assignment, or?
Yeah, I should put that together. Yes, I think that's reasonable to do rather than doing the other lab report. I think that that's totally reasonable to do. And so I'll try to get that up in there too. Let me look here for a second. Not seeing what I want. So I gotta go back to. Different semester. We've blasted through material. All right, well, maybe I have to make up problems. Okay, let me start screen share. All right, so here's a problem. And I think do it that way. Okay, so this is a conjugate addition problem, or a, excuse me, a electrophilic addition on a diene. And what I want is I want the major product. So what you have to do is, well, why don't you tell me what we need to consider? Take a look at it and figure out where we need to start or what we need to do. Let's start here. How many locations can the proton add? I've got one. One location with proton can add. JC's got four with a question mark. I always like that there's like the question mark. AJ's got a question mark too. Want to say four? You can say more than four. Whenever we take a look at a double bond, let's say that we've got a double bond that's asymmetrical and it picks up a proton. It can pick up the proton on either side of the double bond. And so each double bond allows for two additions. So the proton can add to either side. So when we take a look at this and we're asking how many locations can the proton add, with two double bonds, there's four different carbons onto which the proton can add. So what we need to do is, once we decide that there are four different locations, then we should draw them all. So number one, decide on how many locations it can add to. Number two, draw each resulting cation. From all four additions. And just go down the line. So what we can do is we can label them 1, 2, 3, 4. And as such, we'll start with number one and we'll do the addition to carbon number one. In doing the addition to carbon number one, that puts the proton here and the positive charge in that location. Taking a quick sneak look at where my next double bond is and the rest of that molecule, that's what I would come out with. On number two, we'll do the proton addition there. The positive charge winds up on the left-hand side. And so the proton that we're adding and where the positive charge is going, so we don't get it confused with other protons. Number three. And then finally, number four. Okay. So everybody agree that I've gone through and done those four correctly? Keegan's voting for number four. All right. So do any of these, now that we've drawn all four of them, is there any resonance that we should consider with these on any of these numbers one through four? Once we draw a carbocation like this, we should then sort of investigate, is there any sort of resonance? On one and four, there is resonance. So two is isolated. Actually, let's do it this way. Let's say no resonance. This is isolated. This one also no resonance. This is isolated. But on number one, we can do resonance. So that gives a carbocation in that location. And we can track that proton still. Maybe that's a good thing to do since we don't want things changing on us. And we can also catch that resonance over here on number four. Okay. So there's all four of them. Do any of these look more stable than the others? Number four, Drew, why number four? Kelly's number four. Everybody's saying number four. What's up with number four?
There's two trisubstituted cations.
Awesome, Drew, thank you. So this is a tertiary carbocation and a tertiary carbocation. And up here, we have a secondary and a secondary. So indeed, it looks like the tertiary and tertiary is the most stable. Okay, so what we have done so far in going through in the way that we have analyzed this is we've taken, let's see if we can draw sort of an energy diagram of what's going on here. We have taken a molecule. And we have protonated it with HCl. So this will be the start of our energy diagram. There are four different possible intermediates. And I'll sort of label them out here. And then each one of these goes to one of these intermediates. This is going to be the easiest way for me to do this. Okay, and so each one of these intermediates, in terms of order in which they're going, if we look at each of them, this one's a tertiary, this one's a secondary. And so the order is looking like four is the most stable. And then number one is the second most stable. Number two and then number three in the order of stability. And this is your rate determining step and your activation energy here. And once we get to number four, then what we've got is another question from number four, which is that this cation that we're looking at is a resonance stabilized carbocation. So there's one position. It's a little bit hard to fit this in where I want it here, but let's see what we can do. There's the other position. And from that, we can make two products that come out of that. And so the two products that come out of that are where the chloride binds in that position. And where the chloride binds in the first position. And these two are looking like they're pretty equivalent. This would be the 1-2 addition. And this would be the 1-4 addition. Now, stability wise, they're both about equal stability because as we're looking at it, they're both tri-substituted for the double bond. This one is tri-substituted for the double bond. And there's no real difference about where the chlorine is adding. And so both of these, I would say, are pretty equivalent energy-wise. But there is a difference between 1-2 and 1-4 addition. 1-4 addition is generally considered to be the thermodynamic, or at least it takes more energy. For migration of the chloride. This one takes less energy. The so-called direct substitution. And sometimes we can get kinetic versus thermodynamic where we get differences in the substitution of the double bond. But in this case, it doesn't look like it. But what we can say is that they probably each have slightly different energies associated with the addition of the chlorine. And so one of them is going to be a little bit smaller in energy and one of them a little bit larger in energy. And so energy diagram wise, this guy is going to come here and this guy is going to come here. And because this one has a slightly lower energy for its transition state, and they're both pretty much equal in terms of their energy of their products, the major one would be expected to be the one that has the lower energy or the direct addition in this case, given no other differences. Now, I think what I was trying to do in my head is I was trying to come out with one that was going to be different between the 1-2 and the 1-4 in the substitution pattern. And I need to modify my molecule in order to do that. But I think that that this concept is what is probably the main concept that I really want to get into, is looking at the different possibilities of adding to the diene system, the different cations that can be created, how to draw them all out, how to assess them and rank them. And then your major is always going to be through this. And then you have two options. You weigh those two options and we look at 1-2 versus 1-4. Usually it's kinetic versus thermodynamic. And then we take a look at the conditions and we decide, are we going for the kinetic or are we going for the thermodynamic based on what the conditions are.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah, Keegan.
So for the thermo, it has a higher activation energy, but it ends up being at a lower state.
No, not always. In this case, I would say that these two are pretty much in identical state because the substitution of the double bond is identical in this case. So I may have drawn this just slightly lower. That was not really to be intentionally lower. they're almost equal in energy. So if I wanted one that was different in energy, I have to change the structure of the molecule slightly in order to get one that's different in energy.
I had another question.
Yep.
Would the chlorine being in the middle of the molecule make it more stable, or is that a very insignificant effect?
Very insignificant.
Okay.
It's more about the substitution of the double bond and direct versus indirect addition. So the factors that we want to weigh is that we want to look at substitution of double bond, more substituted equals more stable. And number two, direct, which is 1-2 addition, versus conjugate, which is the 1-4 addition. And in this case, what we find is that 1-2 direct requires less energy. For addition, we could say, let's do it this way. We'll add in one more here. 1-4 requires more energy. To allow for migration of the nucleophile.
I had another question.
Yep.
So when you say that, are you assuming that the it would be this, like, both are tertiary or both are secondary? Like, assuming those are the same, because if it...
Let me try and do one more.
Two tertiary.
Let's do one more and let's see what happens, okay. Keegan. Let me grab a problem that I was working on earlier that I was trying to reproduce that I didn't capture. It's this one. This is what I was trying to reproduce in my head and managed not to get there. I got close to it. Very similar looking problem. I think it just has one less carbon in it that allows for some complexity. Let's go through and do the same thing. See how this one works out. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through and draw each of the resulting protonations. So we'll protonate at carbon number one. Protonate at number two. Let's protonate at number three. And then finally, number four. Notice how, I was going to say, I turn my brain off while I'm going through and doing these protonations. I don't really, but what I'm doing is I'm not asking other questions. I sort of compartmentalize and deal with one issue at a time before I move on to the next issue. So the first thing that I do is I go through and I just concentrate and put all my energy into protonating each one of the positions and getting the structures correct. And I don't do anything else while I do that. Then once I do that, then I go back and I start to assess. And I start to ask the question, is there any resonance or any other stabilization? So what can we tell me about number one? Is there any resonance with number one?
Yes, you migrate that double bond.
Yeah. Oops. That's what I'm talking about, being careful and making sure that you're getting everything, capturing everything accurately. Okay. And let's move on to number two. Any resonance from number two? No. What about number three? Nope, no resonance. What about number four? Yes, number four, I can resonate the bond between the second and third carbon. And putting that hydrogen back in is just good practice, just so that we can keep track of where that hydrogen is going. That also allows us to more easily see where we're doing 1-2 addition versus where we might be doing 1-4 addition for the different possible cations. Okay, now that we've got all the cations, now we can sort of assess and we can rank them, right? So now what we can do is we can go back and we can say, all right, look, this one here is secondary. This one is tertiary. This one here is tertiary. This one here is tertiary. No great difference between those two. This one is tertiary. And tertiary. Okay, so out of all of those, how do I rank them? Which one is the most stable?
Four and then one.
Yep. So it looks like four is more stable than one, which is more stable than two, which is approximately equal to number three. So in terms of these, we can't really rank two and three. Two and three are pretty much equal, but we can say that four is definitely more stable than one, and one is definitely more stable than two and three. So in terms of an energy,
hey, Jason, with two and three, I'm just curious real quick, can you consider a hydride shift to rank one over the other? Because in number three, you could hydride shift to form another tertiary substitute cation. And with a hydride shift in two, it would create a a secondary substituted. Would that come into play possibly to rank those?
Okay, so what would come into play is that if we were to look at these and the hydride shift, the hydride shift would occur. So we could go, my arrow's not a really good arrow there. Hydride shift could occur, but if it does occur, it's going to take you to this cation. And the reason that it would occur is because it is now the allylic cation with resonance. And in fact, that allylic cation is same as number one. So that takes you up to number one. If the shift were to occur in number three, and this would shift that way, and we say hydride shift, then what happens with this one is it shifts to give me that carbocation, which is the same as number four. But the question of the shift or not shifting, shifting is always secondary. So if I'm looking at an energy diagram, and let's do an energy diagram that looks like this, and I had four, one, and then these guys, this is hard to do when they're like in, I'm just gonna draw an energy diagram here that is maybe both of them. So our most stable is four, then one, three, and two, right? And so energy-wise, I'm looking kind of like this, where I've got my different energies. And then this guy here, three shifts to four. So there's a small energy gap and a shift there. And there's a small energy gap and a shift here to one. But this takes time and energy. And the problem is already decided right here, because this is your rate determining step. So it's always the first lowest activation energy step here that is setting which pathway your reaction is going to go on. And so we're already on this road as my rate determining step. And everything else is secondary to that. So that's a great question in asking what's going to happen with a hydride shift. But let's say that one of these hydride shifts and it goes to something even more stable than four. Still, this is going to be the major product, because this is going to be that much lower in energy to begin with. And so everything is going to wind up going through this reaction. See, what you need to remember is that in a chemical reaction, there is a Boltzmann distribution of energies. Not my best drawing. Let's see if I can do this better. You remember the concept of Boltzmann distribution of energies? So if this is energy, increasing energy on the x-axis, and on the y-axis, this is percent of molecules that have a particular energy. This is the average. And that average sort of equals the temperature. When you have an activation energy, let's say that this energy here, let's call this guy E sub A one. Let's say that this has E sub A two, and this one has, well, let's actually correspond them with their numbers. This will be E sub A two, three. This will be E sub A one. This will be E sub A four. Those different energies probably correspond to something like this, where this is E sub A four, E sub A one, and E sub A two, three. That means that all of these molecules that are to the right of this can make it over that activation energy barrier. They have enough energy to be able to get over energy barrier E sub A4 and start making product. Only these molecules that are on this line have enough energy to make it over E sub A1, which means that less molecules make it over that and can go on to make that product, making less of that product. Going up to this one, it takes even more energy. And so going all the way up here, only these molecules out at that level have that amount of energy. And those are what are going to give you your relative proportions of products that come out of this. And why we get major and minor products that are coming out is because only so many molecules can make it over that activation energy barrier. And what happens after those molecules make it over that activation energy barrier? Let's say that what happens if I take some of these molecules out, I need to do this down here because I need to sort of like do a progression. Let's say that we remove all of these. As they go to product. What happens to the Boltzmann distribution? What happens to the shape of the curve? The shape of the curve changes, and actually, I'm not going to do it that way. The shape of the curve looks like this now. And this is the new average temperature. So the curve has fallen back. And the entire system has cooled down to the point where now, because there's a new average, you had to take out these molecules. Now you had to re-average everything. These molecules on average are moving slower than the original population. The entire system has cooled down. And the reaction has stopped. Because now there's no more products with enough energy to make it over the activation energy barrier, unless you continue to pump heat into the system and heat the system and drive the system forward. But otherwise, the reaction just stops. So wouldn't that only be the case if it were endo? Not yes and no. Yes, I should go with endo, but the reactions that we're looking at are endo, because as we're looking at them and going up into here, we're looking at initially going up to a much less stable product, and we're going to an endothermic type of reaction. Now, what happens overall when we make the product could be that it's kinetic, not endo, but exothermic. And as it's exothermic, then you're going to get some energy that's coming out that's warming the system up. And yes, that can drive the reaction forward. But initially, just looking at this first rate and what's happening within this first rate, this is sort of the evaporative cooling process, or the same process that drives evaporative cooling, that when you remove the high energy molecules, the entire system then cools down and the entire system slows down. But I think the point that I really want to get at is that while there may be other things that can happen, such as hydride shifts and things, that we generally want to consider when there aren't other possibilities. For instance, if number three were only the reaction pathway that it could go, and then it could do hydride shifts, it will. And these hydride shifts will become the major products. But that's because the reaction could only go to three. But if there are other options like one and four, then all of the reactivity will go through four. And I'll never get to these points where I'm doing these hydride shifts and making these other things. Is that making sense? In terms of just understanding what happens when I have multiple possible things, where my rate determining step is looking at your lowest activation energy for your rate determining step. Okay, so now what we need to do is we need to go back and we need to consider number four as being my most stable. And I need to look at direct addition and conjugate addition for number four. So we have the two different cations that are created. When the chloride adds to this one, the chloride is going to add in that position. And we have added 1-2 addition. When the chloride adds to this guy, I'm adding in a 1-4 fashion. So this is direct. This is conjugate. 1-2 addition. 1-4 addition. There's something else that's different about these two. What else is different between these two? Actually, maybe there's not. Maybe these two are still. I thought these two gave me different. Substitutions, and they don't. I thought that I said in this last problem. No, they're both tertiary. Yeah, same problem that I get here. Okay, so there isn't. My recollection of what I was doing yesterday is still not square on. I was trying to see if these guys were going to come out with different substitutions.
Let's try. Hey, Jason?
Yeah.
I had a question. So in the previous problem, we said that the thermo was when it was the 1-4. And then we also said previously in the class that if it's more substituted at the double bond, it's thermo. So what if the 1-2 is when it's more substituted and the 1-4 is when it's less? Then which one's thermo?
That's a great question. Okay, so the question is, if we get 1-2 direct and this is more substituted, and we get 1-4, this is conjugate, and it is less substituted. And the question is, which one is thermo? And which is kinetic? Okay, so I don't have a good drawing to put to this. Maybe what I could do, let me see if I can create one. So if I do a 1-2 direct substitution that is going to be more substituted, there's a tetra substituted, and I do a 1-4 chlorine's going to have to go over here. double bond goes there. So this would be 1, 2, 3, 4. Let's number the other way. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, and 4. And I just want to clean up this chlorine. It's not like a net bond angle. Okay, this would be the indication that we're talking about. And which one is kinetic and which one is thermodynamic? This is an outstanding question. And these would have arisen from a series of cation that look like this after the addition of the hydrogen. Okay, and in terms of substitution, if we look at substitution, that guy is tetra-substituted, but is 1,2 addition, and this one is tri, and is 1,4. Okay, so which one is kinetic and which one is thermodynamic? Let me ask you, which one is the more stable of these products? The 1,2 addition or the 1,4 addition? Which one is more stable, just looking at the double bond? Let's do it this way, this is easier. Let's call this one A, and let's call this one B. Which one is more stable, A or B? A, clearly A, because it's tetra-substituted. So this one is more stable. Which one took less energy to form, A or B? A, Drew, on it. Okay, so that means that this one is less stable and it took more energy to form. Okay, so energy wise, here's my intermediate. Here's my two products, one that is more stable, A, and one that is less stable, B. A took less energy. So A went through this pathway in order to make A. B took more energy. This is what the pattern looks like. And this is the allylic carbocation. It's at that position. So this one is the kinetic product because it forms the fastest. This one is also the thermodynamic product because it's the most stable. That may be a little bit confusing, but these guys up here determine kinetic, which one is kinetic. And these guys down here determine what is thermodynamic. So this one is the lowest energy and is the kinetic. And this one is the lowest energy and is the thermodynamic. And so A is both kinetic and thermodynamic. You know what that means? A is major under all conditions. You can't change the product ratio by changing the conditions. There is no way to favor B. There's no way to make more of B than there is to make A, because A is both kinetic and thermodynamic. It's made the fastest and it's the most stable. This is most reactions. Most reactions look this way. It is only some reactions that look the other way. So what I would say is that this is sort of, most reactions have this sort of look to them. And this is kinetic and thermo. So most reactions fall into that category that we've looked at. There's only some reactions that have this concept of lower energy, less stable, more energy, but more stable, where this becomes the kinetic and this becomes the thermodynamic. This is kinetic, what we say is kinetic versus thermodynamic. And here you can favor the two products with different types of conditions. So that what we can do here is this is low temp, short reaction times. This is high temp and longer reaction times. This one's major under all conditions. So Keegan, that was a great question because it highlights the two different types of reactions that we can have. Is everybody understanding that? Any other questions on how that can be? And these are really the only two possibilities. There aren't really any other possibilities other than this. These are your two sort of reaction diagrams that come out. And we highlight this one and we say, you know, that this one is kinetic versus thermodynamic is sort of a special case. And that's why we give it that special name. And there are a lot of reactions that fall into that. But most of the reactions that we study and looked at fall under this normal sort of concept that we have products that are less stable. And those less stable products oftentimes, in terms of their energy, require more energy.
Jason, I had another question. When you say most reactions, are you talking specifically about organic chemistry or just in general?
Well, that's a good question. I don't do a lot of inorganic reactions, but I have to imagine that the inorganic reactions are not that different than the organic reactions. I mean, we have, for the inorganic reactions, there are many less outcomes. In the inorganic reactions, you're really looking at certain types of reactions. You're looking at acid base. You're looking at you're looking at redox reactions, transfers of electrons. You're looking at double displacement. There's a number of different reactions that you look at, and all of those sort of have one outcome because of the greater simplicity of the inorganic materials. That's not to say that there aren't more complicated inorganic reactions that can sometimes have multiple mechanisms or multiple steps. Those more complicated inorganic reactions are probably going to be very similar to the organic reactions, just in terms of some products are going to be more stable and less stable. And I don't know if kinetic versus thermodynamic plays into those inorganic reactions, but I would imagine that it does, and that there are analogs and examples that we could find within the inorganic reactions as well. I would not be surprised, but I'm not familiar with any. It's just not an area that I study. But I imagine energetically that it would be very much the same, because if we had multiple products, the possibility of having some that are more stable and some that are less stable, and then having transition states and energies that are different would set up a kinetic versus thermodynamic situation with some of those products as well. And I think that that is probably very much true in terms of looking at formations of minerals and the types of minerals that can be formed upon combining those different. I know that there are different structures, frameworks that the inorganics can form given the same ingredients. And we wind up with different mineral names, even though they have very similar amounts of elements of each different type of element that go into them. And whether they form one way or another way is determined by how much energy was in the system and whether they formed fast, or whether they were allowed to, over millions of years, slowly go more to their thermodynamic product that is a more stable, more stronger bonding type system. And so, yeah, I think that just the reaction timescale that we look at in the inorganics is very different than the reaction timescale that we look at in the organics, but that we could draw the very same conclusions. That's an interesting idea that I had not really considered. I just don't deal with inorganics. But yeah, I could see many places where that could be the case. All right. What else do we need to do here? I feel like we've kind of covered a good deal of information and some important concepts. And I think I've given you a better system for how to tackle these types of problems by taking them particularly here, asking how many locations can the proton add, making sure that you look at all four locations, drawing all four out, assessing stability of each and drawing any resonance associated with them. After drawing the resonance, rank them. After ranking them, take your lowest energy one, and then draw the products from the lowest energy one, and then assess the stabilities of those in the possible kinetic versus thermodynamic, and then take a look at your reaction temperatures and reaction conditions and decide whether or not you're in kinetic or thermodynamic. Now, how do you decide? How do you decide between kinetic versus thermodynamic in terms of conditions? Maybe that's one last thing that we can deal with. Different conditions are complicated, and I would say that it's not easy. Easy would be if I did something that was like HCl 0 degrees C kinetic conditions, and I wrote conditions down underneath it, and I told you whether it was the kinetic conditions, or if I told you something like HCl and we were at 80 degrees C for 4 hours. This, and I wrote thermo. Absence of that, what I tend to do is I tend to look at the temperatures, and that if the temperature is less than 0 degrees, let's say less than or equal to 0 degrees C, or the time is in minutes, I usually say that this is, or feel like this is under kinetic control. If the temperature is at refluxing temperature for the solvent. Or time in hours. Usually this will imply thermodynamic. And that's the way that I usually break it up. So oftentimes I will tell you that it's kinetic control or thermodynamic control. But absence of me telling you, if you're trying to look at something and you're trying to gauge, and they give you temperatures and they give you time, then temperatures that are sort of less than or equal to 0 degrees C or time in minutes is usually kinetic. And if you're at refluxing temperature and your time in hours, then you're thermodynamic. The other big point here that I would say is that if no temp or time is given, then you should always assume that it's under thermodynamic. Why do we do that? Because usually we run a reaction to its completion. Usually we're heating reactions or trying to push them. And so if they give you a reaction where there is no temperature and is no time, then it is generally assumed that you're looking for the thermodynamic product and that the reaction is being run under thermodynamic conditions. And that's probably the best assumption. Does that help to clear that up in terms of looking at reactions? And why do I say refluxing for a solvent? Because different solvents have different temperatures for their refluxing. And so if you're in ethanol and you're at 78 degrees Celsius, that's its boiling point for ethanol. Methanol has a 68 degree boiling point. And so depending upon what solvent you're in, sometimes you'll see different temperatures. If you're in toluene, boiling point of toluene, which is the aromatic with the methyl group in it, is 110 degrees. And so the temperature sort of changes as this is the hottest temperature that you can get within that solvent. The hottest temperature you can get within methanol is 68. The hottest temperature you can get within toluene is 110. So you're heating these the maximum heat that you can apply to it, which is why I say refluxing temperature for the solvent as a good judge. So if you're refluxing it and you're heating it to its maximum extent, then you're generally going thermodynamic because you're putting the maximum amount of heat into the system that you can. And that's why I don't give it a temperature per se, because that temperature can vary a lot depending upon what the solvent is. If you're down around 0 degrees C, here you're obviously cooling because you're below room temperature. And so you had to do something to it to get it down to 0 degrees C. And so if you're cooling below room temperature, then you're cooling it and that's going to give you the kinetic product. Now, what happens if no temperature is given? Then I sort of assume room temperature. Well, room temperature, where does that sit? Room temperature is not heating and it's not cooling. Then what is room temperature? That's a good question. And so that's why we say if no temperature is given, it's just best to assume that it's thermodynamic conditions because they're not telling you anything special about it. How does that sit? Reasonable? Okay. Maybe that's all we want to do this morning. Maybe we cut it a little bit short this morning. And I'll go bust my tail on grading stuff. Unless there's any other questions or you guys want me to address any other things.
I got a question, but it's not about like what we just did.
Okay, go ahead, JC.
So for me, I know you've been like super flexible with grading like turning in stuff. So yeah. I guess opted not to turn in the exam until I got the mass spec. One, do you want me to just like turn it in so you can at least see that I did it and then readjust it, or keep holding off until we get that back like today or tomorrow?
No, that's cool. You'll get it back today.
Okay,
and
cool.
And then you can decide what you want to do with it. That's fine.
Right. Sweet. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions?
I had a question, but it's kind of like on a comment on my quiz.
Oh, okay. Maybe what we can do is, I don't know. Do you want to address it here with everybody, or you want to address it on camera? Or you want me to do that individually?
I mean, whatever. I don't really care.
That's just being respectful in how you wanted to address it. I don't know. Do you feel like it would be helpful for other people?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, then let's go ahead and leave it. Let's go for it.
All right. So, I'm talking about the NMR quiz.
Yep.
I had the final product of a benzene ring with the carboxylic acid and then the CH2O, CH3 para to each other. And you were talking about how to distinguish basically where you put the CH2.
Yep.
Yeah.
So the difference is whether that CH2 goes here or here.
Yeah. So, you wrote the look at the CNMR, and you had 125 and 158. Are you saying that it would be 158 if it was attached to the carboxylic acid? And 125 if it was the methoxy.
So here is 158. This was 178. This is 125. And the other ones aren't quite as important. And what I'm indicating is that you have X and Y, and that this one is X and this one is Y. And the question that I'm asking is, what is the difference here indicating? Let's ask a different question before we do that. Let's take these and let's do some predictions. And then let's maybe go try and decide. So let's leave that CH2 off for a minute. And instead of dealing with the CH2, let's deal with this, these two. And let's draw a little prediction about what we expect for those versus the other aromatics. So we know the other aromatics are not really going to change. And so we'll just kind of draw them in. And this is around the 125-ish and the 158. Okay. Now, on this one, this is a CH2 group, which is connected to that carbon. And this is a carbonyl that is connected to it. Over here, I've got a CH2 connected to it and an oxygen directly connected to it. How do I feel about these two? Or actually, let me just take this. This overall, out of these four, which one of these four carbons that I have highlighted, and let's do it this way. One, two, three, and four. Which carbon is going to be farthest downfield? One, two, three, or four? What's the strongest electron in the drawing group? JC's got it, three. Three is the strongest electron in the drawing group.
See, I would have said, I would have almost argued two because you have two oxygen.
Ah.
Even though it's further away.
Ah. And that is a misconception. So when you are connected to a carbon, regardless of the electron withdrawing groups that are on the carbon, you can have multiple electron withdrawing groups and you are connected through the carbon and looking at what happens here versus a carbon that is directly connected to an oxygen. And what happens is induction falls off with distance. And it falls off so fast with distance that being connected through the carbon, the biggest effect on these electron withdrawing groups is on that carbon, not on this carbon. And so the oxygen is the 400-pound gorilla. The oxygen is, or the 800-pound gorilla, gorillas are heavy. The oxygen is really ripping the electron density out of that carbon. And this guy is much smaller partial positive. And so the carbonyl is not nearly as electron withdrawing as directly connected to an oxygen. We can see that by looking at a number of different things. We can see that, I guess, one of the ways to see it would be that proton versus that proton. Okay, so this is an aldehyde type proton. I mean, this is an ester, but this proton is connected to the end of the carbonyl. And as such, it does have a big partial positive to it, but it's not labile because when it comes off, you're leaving behind a carbanion that has no resonance, and it just it's not protic, right? In the way that we say that this one is not protic. And over here, this one is the alcohol, and this one has the largest partial positive. And can hydrogen bond? It's protic, it's labile, it comes off. It's being directly connected to a strong electron withdrawing group, the oxygen, that allows this proton to be acidic in the way that it is. These two oxygens, yes, they tug on this, but they tug more on the carbon than they do on that proton. And this proton does not have the same chemical ability to be able to come off and do things. And if I were to look at it in the proton NMR, this proton, well, it gets deshielded, but because of currents, ring currents that happen with the magnetic field in the carbonyl, more so than it's deshielding like an alcohol deshields. But I think its nature is more appropriately understood by looking at its chemical properties, and that this one is protic and this one is aprotic, that is reading into and telling us about the nature of these two carbons and how these two carbons are really different. So the stronger electron withdrawing group is always directly connected to an oxygen. So what that's going to do is that's going to tell me that this guy is going to be way far downfield someplace. And that this one that is connected to a CH2 is going to be more similar to these guys that are already here and sort of in that bunch with them someplace. And it may move, you know, it may be here or it might be here, but it's going to be in that range. And that this one is going to be downfield. Now, what happens here? This is connected to a carbon. This is connected to a carbon. This means that these two protons are, one is probably going to be downfield and one sort of in here someplace. and they may both float to a little degree, but they're both going to be pretty close to what these two, the rest of these carbon systems are in here. So now we go back and we look at the spectrum that was given to us and how these are our aromatics. So if I go through and I just sort of highlight the systems, I would say that the CH3, wasn't the CH3 in front of the CH2? I think it looked like this. And so the CH3, no question where that CH3 is. The CH2, we know where it sits, and this would kind of be appropriate for both locations. It's hard to say, you know, I'd like to see that this one would be downfield, but these, the CH3 and the CH2 would be very close. Here, we might assume that the CH3 and the CH2 would have more distance in them, but because of the ring currents that are happening here being attached to the ring and how the ring de-shields things, it can draw that downfield pretty similarly. And yet the three carbons are downfield from the two, I shouldn't say carbons, the three hydrogens on the CH3 are downfield from the two hydrogens on the CH2. These guys would not change. So in picking these, and we don't know which is which necessarily, those don't really change. The carbonyl, we definitely know. And the carbonyl doesn't change. What does change and what is different is what's happening. And I need another good color. I've sort of exhausted all my colors. Maybe that is what's happening there. And different. And that's really the only distinguishable place to look. And it's all about finding the place to look and being able to do this skill, being able to predict and remembering that directly connected to an oxygen is always downfield, is always, the oxygen is always the stronger electron withdrawing group as compared to other groups. That directly connected to an oxygen is always going to be your most downfield. The only exception being something like this. Where that is going to come way downfield of something directly connected to an oxygen in this way, because fluorine is even more electron withdrawing than oxygen. But we just don't see fluorides very often. This is just like rare, and this is common. And so we keep an eye on the oxygens and directly connected to the oxygens.
So I've got like a follow-up to this then, because I think I did the same thing. And
most people did.
Yeah, I was really relying heavily on that, the proton NMR, for that distinction between where to put the CH2 groups.
Yeah.
So why did that mislead me? Why was I so like, oh yeah, that makes sense. It's in the right range.
Well, but Kelly, if I remember correctly on your quiz,
That's crazy, but yeah.
JC. I was looking at Kelly's name in the chat and I failed to look over to see who was actually speaking. I apologize. JC, I'm trying to remember your quiz. Oh, and JC, didn't I write on the top of your quiz that you had an excellent argument?
Yeah, like you gave me full points and like the answer was wrong, but that I argued it really well.
Right, exactly. Okay, so you see my grading. That what I liked was the fact that you looked at it and you looked for it and you argued it. And you chose to argue it from the proton NMR. And you're welcome, Keegan, if you're jumping out. You chose to argue it from the proton NMR. and you didn't look as heavily at the carbon. And the carbon may have led you to a different question. But the fact that you looked at it and that you drilled into it and that you argued it is what I was looking for. And most of the places, people made this exact same mistake and I made the exact same comment. But what most people didn't do is most people didn't argue it. Most people picked one or the other, but most people didn't show both. And for those people that did show both, most of the people that did just chose one or the other and didn't really go into why they chose one or the other. And so those people that argued it, if they argued it from the proton NMR and they looked at both these options and understood that they were hard to decide between and chose the wrong one because they argued it from the proton NMR, I gave full credit for. If they just picked one and there was no argument, then I tried to get them to see that they needed to make an argument and just docked one point because they still did a really good job. They just didn't go that one extra point. So to your question, why did the proton NMR lead you in the wrong place? And I think that the answer to that, if we look at the proton NMR, you had two singlets. You had a singlet. This is going to be harder to draw. Let me see if I can do it justice. You had a singlet that integrated for three. You had a singlet that integrated for two. You then had the aromatics, which were here, which were sort of symmetrical and either looked like the inverted quartet, if you could zoom in enough, or looked like doublets. So this was around seven. This was around 3.8 and 3.6, I think-ish. And then you had the little bump out here at 12 that exchanged. And I'm trying to think if there was anything else. Oh, these integrated for two and two. And that integrated for one. Okay, so the question then is, these two were very close to each other. And how did they lead you into picking the wrong thing? Well, I think they led you into picking the wrong thing because of how close they were. And that what you assumed was that if they were far apart, that that would argue for the other molecule. And because they were so close, you allowed it to argue for the one that you did. Okay, so what I would say is that in this system, yes, I would agree that they should be very close. They should both be close to 4.0 because everything that's connected to an oxygen should be close to 4.0, and this one should be two. And the question is, what is that one? Where is that one going to end up, right? When you have an aromatic ring system, the proton that is here winds up being, that did not do what I wanted it to do, winds up being deshielded because of the ring currents. And I'm not doing this justice either. I hate it when I can't exactly draw what I want. Let me try one more time, slow it down. The ring currents take the pi electrons that are in the ring system and those pi electrons, as the magnetic field takes and does sort of this donut thing, what winds up happening is the magnetic field here winds up stripping electron density away from the proton in an interesting way, and it deshields the proton. This is why protons that are on an aromatic ring system usually show up around 7 and 8. So this is a CCH aromatic, whereas carbon-carbon double bonds, not aromatic, this is alkane or alkene. Let's say that this is AR, aromatic, whereas the alkene is upfield from that. It's because of the ring current. And the ring current not only deshields protons, but it deshields carbons that are in the same position that are next to the ring system. And so what happens in this molecule is that those ring currents are deshielding this and moving this downfield from where we would expect it. And what that does is it moves it downfield and it moves it close to where this one is. And so they're showing up close because the ring current is causing it to move downfield, in addition to the electron withdrawing group, which wouldn't normally be that strong. Normally we would expect this like around 2, maybe 2.5, but it's falling all the way down at 3.6. So how could I predict and say, how would I know, you know, between these two by looking at the proton NMR? I would say that the proton NMR would be very challenging between these two to tell the difference, and that these two would be very close, but given the ring current and what the ring current would do to this guy versus just the oxygen, you can think of this as being like this. I would think of this as one electron withdrawing group and a second electron withdrawing group. That would pull this one downfield of the methyl. And so the expectation here is that I would expect integration of 2, integration of 3 in that pattern. Whereas on this one, I would expect this would definitely be downfield and this would be slightly upfield. And so this one, I would expect 3 and 2 in that way. That is very subtle. And so, like I said, I loved your argument. And I think that you made a totally valid argument. Why wasn't it spot on? I think this is the reason that it wasn't quite spot on, is that this was a more subtle thing that I had not taught you to look for in the proton NMR.
So hypothetically, completely hypothetical here, if we encountered a similar situation in some other problem, all hypothetical, of course, we should maybe not bank on that same logic of using proton NMR and kind of being like, well, it's in this range, but it's like close enough to that. And we should look at the CNMR more, right? If we're trying to make that distinction.
What I think I would pull away from this, JC, is that you did an outstanding job in arguing for your product and that you got points, full credit, not because you were correct, but because you used outstanding logic in the way that you argued for your product. And the takeaway is that I'm looking for that logic and that explanation more than I am looking for the right answer. That a wrong answer with very good logic is still an outstanding answer and deserves full credit. Which is why I'm trying to say that maybe the quiz does not weigh in as heavily as you might think in your decision-making in getting full credit in the exam type situation.
And yeah, then, of course, it was more about like, you know, ideally you don't want to repeat your same mistakes if you can learn from them. So sure. If I'm facing a similar kind of like decision-making process and I was using my same logic, perhaps I don't bank on that exact same thing and I look more, I think your hint makes more sense on the CNMR. I was a little thrown by that, but I think this maybe clarifies it a little bit.
Good. Yeah, I think that goes a long way. Yes, I would say that banking on the same logic then and trying to decide where something goes if you were just looking at how close they were, and you were using that logic of how close these two are, and saying that these two look like they're in more identical environment, and given how close that these look, then this should go that way. I think instead, looking at it and saying, yes, these are close, but this has two electron withdrawing groups on it, which might pull it slightly downfield of the one that only has one electron withdrawing group, versus here where you have sort of two electron withdrawing groups that are tugging on this one, and that the ring current combined might get them close. But definitely what I should see is something directly connected to an oxygen downfield that sort of falling back on that concept of finding the one that should be downfield, and then looking to see, is that one actually downfield in the spectrum, is perhaps a better logic than trying to say how close a proximity they are and how close two signals are. For this molecule, for other molecules, it might be a little bit different.
All right, that makes sense. Thank you.
But I would say that's the logic. That's the difference in the logic that I would look for.
And then really quick notation-wise, I'm just tweaky with it. If I do, I'm going to do a chat thing. If I do this, it means like a J3 and a J4, right? That's like a double doublet. That's not like a true actual double doublet, right?
That is my notation only, and I have never seen anybody use a J3, J4 in that way, but that's because I have never seen anyone distinguish between a J3 and a J4 in a reasonable way. I have never seen a double doublet distinguished between a J3 and a J4, and so I'm trying to come up and give you some sort of nomenclature. That's my system. That's my understanding, that if you were to do that, I see that as a J3 and a J4 double doublet.
Okay, cool.
So yes, that is correct. If you do that in somebody else's class or try to do that with somebody else someplace else, they're not going to know what the heck you're saying, and you're just going to have to explain it to them. And Kelly, so do we just resubmit if we add things to our exam? Yeah, if you want to change something, just go ahead and just resubmit it and give me a second submission, and I'll pull from the second submission. Okay. I think this was a good session this morning. You're welcome. All right, that's all I got, unless you guys have any other questions. All right, take care, you guys.